This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Philip Roth has written a terrific political novel, though in a style his readers might never have predicted, a fable of an alternative universe in which America has gone fascist and ordinary life has been flattened under a steamroller of national politics and mass hatreds. That's a quote from the opening of the front-page New York Times Sunday Book Review of Philip Roth's new novel, The Plot Against America. The novel takes off from this premise. What if the famous aviator Charles Lindbergh was the Republican Party's nominee for president in 1940 and he defeated FDR? And what if President Lindbergh, a Nazi sympathizer, made pacts with Germany and Japan, kept America out of the war, and instituted policies in America to relocate Jewish families to the heartland to encourage them to assimilate? Although the historical premise is fiction, the main character in this novel is the 9-year-old Philip Roth. It's not the first time Roth has been a character in his fiction. Roth has won the Pulitzer Prize and 2 National Book Awards. His books include Portnoy's Complaint, American Pastoral, and The Human Stain. Let's start with a reading from The Plot Against America. Philip's cousin Alvin wanted to fight against the Nazis, and since America was not joining the war, he fought with Canada. Part of one of his legs was blown off. Alvin will soon be moving in with the Roths. Philip's father has just returned home from visiting Alvin in a Canadian hospital, and Philip has been watching his father sob uncontrollably.
A new life began for me. I'd watched my father fall apart, and I would never return to the same childhood. The mother at home was now away all day working for Haynes. The brother on call was now off after school working for Lindbergh. And the father who defiantly serenaded all those callow cafeteria anti-Semites in Washington was crying aloud with his mouth wide open, crying like both a baby abandoned and a man being tortured, because he was powerless to stop the unforeseen. And as Lindbergh's election couldn't have made clearer to me, the unfolding of the unforeseen was everything. Turned wrong way round, the relentless unforeseen was what we schoolchildren studied as history, harmless history, where everything unexpected in its own time is chronicled on the page as inevitable. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic.
That's Philip Roth reading from his new novel, The Plot Against America. You know, one of the things I really like about reading the novel is that, you know, when we read about World War II and when we read about Hitler's rise to power, we know what happened. We know the Jews should be getting out of Germany. They don't necessarily know that at the time. But when we read your novel, set in America, and Lindbergh doesn't want Americans to go to war, and this anti-Semitism takes root in America, we don't know whether the Jewish families are safe or not. We don't know whether they should be fleeing or not. They don't know either, and we're in the same boat. And that makes it, is real the word I'm looking for? I don't know, but it takes away that hindsight of history and leaves us as unsure as your characters are.
Well, I like what you said, that it takes away the hindsight of history. I have to tell you, I didn't know what they should do either. That's what interested me in the story. Given the threat that American Jews feel when Lindbergh comes to power, because of Lindbergh's previous statements about Jews, which are openly anti-Semitic, they don't know how large a threat they face. They don't know the form in which the threat could be realized. They don't really know if they're really in danger. There is, after all, democracy, American democracy, and all its institutions to protect them. Many people who've written about this book have said it's a story about fascism coming to America, but it's not a story about fascism coming to America. If the Lindbergh administration was openly fascist, the Jews would know very well what to do. If they had any sense, they would leave. But no, it's because all the trappings of democracy are still apparent, and yet Lindbergh is in the White House, that they don't know what to do. And as you know, various people in the book think of various things to do. My mother, for instance, wants to flee to Canada. My father says, no, this is our country, we're going to stay. Good friends of theirs who seem somewhat knowledgeable decide to go, and so on. What I wanted to recreate in the book was something like that uncertainty that must have existed in Germany when Hitler first came to power.
Why did you choose Lindbergh as the president who kind of unleashes anti-Semitism in America? Why make Lindbergh the president?
Well, several reasons. The fundamental reason is very simple. I happened to be reading Arthur Schlesinger's autobiography, which was out in Bound Proof. We share the same publisher. And this was in December of 2000. And I read with great fascination Arthur's description of the 30s and 40s, because, again, I was a small boy, and here was a man who was a grown man living through this epic that I knew something about. And at one point in discussing the 1940 elections, he said that there were members of the right wing of the Republican Party, the very strong isolationist wing, who wanted to run Lindbergh for president, but Lindbergh was never a candidate. That's all he said, and he went on. But the line leaped out at me, and I made a note in the margin saying, what if they had? And as fate would have it, a couple of days later, I happened to have lunch with Arthur, and I said, you know, tell me about that. But there wasn't much more to tell other than what there was in the book. And in a month or so, when I had finished the project I was working on and was looking for a new book to write, I went back to this, and I immediately got started on it. It was an immediate spark plug for me.
Now, President Lindbergh in your novel may be anti-Semitic, but after he's elected, he knows better than to just come out and say it. And he initiates a program that brings young Jewish children to the, quote, heartland to kind of initiate them in the ways of heartland American life. He initiates a homeland program that relocates Jewish families to, you know, quote, heartland places of America. And nobody really knows. The Jewish families don't really know whether this is really meant to be a way of opening up their horizons, of broadening their lives, or whether it's a truly anti-Semitic way of removing them from safe, friendly neighborhoods and putting them in communities that might be very hostile. And in also kind of breaking up the Jewish vote by breaking up Jewish communities. Did you imagine that for Lindbergh to really catch on in America, he would have to use euphemistic language for anything that might truly be anti-Semitic at heart and couch it in the language of, you know, the heartland and just folks and...
Well, they are. It is ambiguous to know what the intention is. For instance, to begin with the first one, which is called Just Folks. That is a program in which Jewish boys from, I think, 10 to 15, if I remember correctly, volunteer, if they want to spend 8 weeks in the summer on a farm somewhere. My brother goes to Kentucky and works on a tobacco farm. They can go to any place that's available where they can do kind of farm work and work they ordinarily wouldn't do. What's wrong with that? Why is it mostly Jews? That's what makes people nervous. But on the face of it, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, when you move on to the next program, which is called Homestead 42, meaning 1942, as opposed to Homestead 1842, which was the original Homestead Act, that is something else. According to that piece of legislation, large corporations are encouraged to transfer their Jewish employees to offices in more remote parts of the country. And in the face of this legislation, my father, whose company is going to move us to Kentucky, quits his job while others go away. That is more coercive. That is, I would say, a bit more ominous. And maybe Lindbergh's hand is shown a little more strongly. On the other hand, if that's all this guy does, it's not so terrible. You know, Lindbergh disappears from my book before he can do any more, so you never really know what he's up to. And again, that's what I wanted. You never really know what he's up to. He's a kind of dim, heroic statue who looms over the book. After Lindbergh disappears, then all hell breaks loose, but not under Lindbergh.
You know, but again, even in that that Homestead Act, you know, that in which corporations relocate Jewish employees. The letter that your father gets in the novel is so euphemistic. Let me just read a few lines from it. You know, Metropolitan Life is proud to be among the very first group of major American corporations and financial institutions selected to participate in the new Homestead program, which is designed to give emerging American families a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to move their households at government expense in order to strike roots in an inspiring region of America previously inaccessible to them. Wow, doesn't that sound great? But, you know, as the family in the novel figures out, this is the government and the corporation joining hands to coerce Jewish families to move.
Mm-hmm. It was great fun writing that letter.
Yeah. yeah, you really got that cheerful corporate PR language down.
I found out what it was like to be Dick Cheney.
Is that the kind of euphemism you feel like we're getting now?
Well, in that regard, well, we always get it. It doesn't matter what administration we get. We got it from Lyndon Johnson during the Vietnam War. Yes, there is always this kind of euphemistic language. This is, of course, coming from the corporation, though probably it's coming from the government. To most people, it would be impenetrable. They would just take it at face value. My father, because he's so committed against Lindbergh from the start, refuses to do what's asked of him.
Philip's cousin, you know, your cousin Alvin in the book, who is something of a hood, hates Hitler and wants to fight against him. And, you know, the United States under Lindbergh is not going to join the war, but he wants to enter it anyway. So he joins the Canadian army and fights against Hitler, but he loses half of one leg in the war and returns with a stump that's covered in ulcers, boils, and scabs. He moves in with the Roth family. And at first it's horrifying to Philip. He says, it was bad enough that we weren't living in a normal country. Now we would never again be living in a normal house. A life of even more suffering was taking shape around me. And he prays to the housekeeping gods to protect our humble five rooms and all they contain from the vengeful fury of the missing leg. In thinking about the impact that this missing leg, this stump, would have on the young Philip Roth's life, did you have anything like it, anything comparable to draw on from your own life?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I had to think my way through it. I think the only thing that comes close, let me say this, I never had it as a child. When I was in the Army, I guess I was in my early 20s, I was in the public information office of Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, and my job was to go out into the wards and get information about soldiers newly arrived who were injured or hurt or whatever, and then write a little press release for the hometown paper. They had a lot of amputees at Walter Reed. Maybe Walter Reed was the center, I don't remember. But they had many amputees. And so I went out on the wards and I talked to these guys. It was sad, as you can imagine. This is just after the Korean War. Or I'd go down to PT with them, physical therapy, and watch them learning to walk on the parallel bars and so on. And so I saw my share of stumps, not just of legs. And the pathos was overwhelming. And so I carried this with me, I think, into the book. And I think it's why it, maybe even why it came to me. In fact, I haven't thought of it till now, but I think perhaps that those experiences had a lot to do with determining how Alvin would be wounded.
There's an amazing scene after Alvin moves back in with the Roth family, and Philip is watching Alvin struggling to bandage the stump so he could put the stump in the prosthetic leg. And, you know, Alvin is just getting so frustrated and disgusted with the difficulty of bandaging it, you know, correctly. So one day when Alvin's out, Philip tries bandaging his own leg to see what's it like. And a scab, one of Alvin's scabs, falls off the bandage onto Philip's leg, and it's just mortifying to him. In fact, I'd like you to read that passage from the novel.
I'd spent the day at school mentally running through what I'd watched him do the night before, but at 3:30 when I got home, I'd only just started to wrap the first bandage around an imaginary stump of my own when, against the flesh below my knee, I felt what turned out to be a ragged scab from the ulcerated underside of Alvin's stump. The scab must have come loose during the night. Alvin had either ignored it or failed to notice it. And now it was stuck to me, and I was out way beyond what I could deal with. Though the heaves began in the bedroom, by racing for the back door and then down the back stairway to the cellar, I managed to position my head over the double sink seconds before the real puking began. To find myself alone in the dank cavern of the cellar was an ordeal under any circumstances, and not only because of the washing machine ringer. With its smudged frieze of mold and mildew running along the cracking, whitewashed walls, stains in every hue of the excremental rainbow and seepage blotches that looked as if they'd leaked from a corpse, the cellar was a ghoulish realm apart, extending beneath the whole of the house and deriving no light at all from the half-dozen slits of grime-clouded glass that looked onto the cement of the alleyways and the weedy front yard.
I really love this passage and about how the horror of finding Alvin's scab on the bandage, the scab that falls onto Philip's own leg, leads him to the basement to puke. And, of course, the basement is the place of his nightmares because of all the mold and mildew and because he always thinks that the ghosts of his dead relatives somehow inhabit the basement and the ghost of his dead neighbor inhabits the basement. So it's this, like, place of horror that so many children have. So many children have that place of horror, whether it's the cellar or some other place. And I guess, you know, we talked a little bit about the prosthetic leg. Can you talk a little bit about the cellar of your home and what horrors that held for you?
You know, when I was writing this book, I went over to Newark, and I went, which is a poor, benighted city in the Maine these days, and has been since 1967 and the riots. I went over to the street Summit Avenue, where I had lived from 1933 to 1942. And I hadn't been back since I left the neighborhood and went off to college. And I went around to the house, and there was a black woman who was downstairs, and she happened to be the landlady. And so I asked her, I told her my story, and how I'd lived there, and that I loved to be able to go back into our flat, which was on the second floor. She was wonderful. She said, sure. And so I went upstairs and I walked around the flat, and I didn't want to leave. And when that was over, I said, now can I see the cellar? I thought I was old enough by now, Terry, and I could, and that I could take it. And I went down the cellar, and alas, it had been changed. It's no longer awful, unfortunately. They built a kind of little apartment down there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually was looking forward to seeing everything that seemed to me so creepy when I was a kid, because that indeed was my experience of the cellar. I dreaded the place, and I had to go down there often. And it's interesting for you to say that this is true of many children. I guess it is.
And just one other thing about that scene I want to ask you. You know, when Alvin's scab, which has clinged to the bandage, falls on Philip's leg, and Philip ends up puking from the horror of it. What made you think about that? About that transferring of the scab?
You're very interested in this scab.
I think it's a really powerful moment, and it kind of like further represents like the horror of the war, the horror of the mutilation of the war, entering first Philip's home and then actually falling onto his own body.
Well, I think you've answered the question actually just then better than I could, which is it has to do with the horror of the war. I mean, the stump is the war to the boy. The stump is politics to the boy. The stump is Lindbergh. It's everything. And a scab is a scab, I don't think that generally we like other people's scabs on our flesh, generally speaking, unless we're maybe physicians or nurses and don't mind. And it's because of the mutilation. The scab is a part of what's been mutilated, and the mutilation is what's so terrifying.
Before I ask the next question, I just want to say a word to parents that this next question is an adult question, and if you're listening with a child and you think it might make you or your child uncomfortable, you might want to tune back in a couple of minutes. Okay, here's the question. There's a wonderful moment where Philip witnesses his cousin Alvin doing something that he doesn't understand. What Alvin is doing, it turns out, is masturbating. And Philip is only seeing a portion of Alvin, so he doesn't really see what's going on. Later, Philip goes to the place where Alvin was and sees this kind of, you know, gooey body fluid stuck on the wall and doesn't know what it is. And what he imagines is that it was something that festered in a man's body and then came spurting from his mouth when he was completely consumed with grief. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. One is that he would so misinterpret what was going on, but also the possibility that a child would imagine that there was a fluid, a sticky fluid that would come spurting from someone's mouth when he was completely consumed with grief is so interesting. Did you ever imagine such a thing?
No, only when I was writing this book. And also, by the way, the place is the cellar.
Yes, that's right.
The nefarious cellar. And it's on one of those dirty, disgusting little walls of the cellar that he sees the ejaculate. No, I never. I worked that through when I was doing the writing. I wanted somehow to capture a side of Alvin's grief that the little boy would not understand. That is his sense that as he was mutilated sexually too, or that he'd lost any possibility of ever being attracted to girls or later to women. And so what he's doing to add to your description is he's looking out of a grimy little cellar window at the girls walking home from high school and looking at their legs, and which he's using as a stimulant. I hope the scene registered in this way. That is that, in fact, my little hero is right. Mm-hmm. To think that it's some liquid that has something to do with grief, because it does. It does in that scene. He's correct. He doesn't know where it comes from. He doesn't know what's going on. But he's understood correctly that a spurt of grief more than of anything else. No, I just thought that through at the time. You know, the effort when you're writing a book is to think through the mental processes of each of the characters as they collide with the events. And so that's how that worked out.
You know, this family, the Roth family in your novel, is facing this new growing wave of anti-Semitism in the United States, and they don't know how far it will go, which of course raises the question, what does being Jewish mean to this family? And you have a beautiful description of what being Jewish means in this neighborhood. You say, it was work that identified and distinguished our neighbors for me far more than religion, and all the men in the neighborhood are either in business for themselves, or they're salesmen, or they're self-employed. Few of them are professionals. But what does being Jewish mean to the Roth family? What did it mean to your family and to your neighbors when you were growing up?
Well, there's another passage, I think, which makes that more explicit, Terry, and answers your question. Their being Jews issued from their being themselves, as did their being American. It was as it was in the nature of things, as fundamental as having arteries and veins, and they never manifested the slightest desire to change it or deny it, regardless of the consequences. So that's the heart of the matter, really, isn't it? As for the observances, some they observed and some they didn't, and so on. And as for their kids, they did what was expected by sending them to Hebrew school, but once we got to be 13, I let it be known on the Sunday after the Saturday of my bar mitzvah, I was not going back, perhaps ever. And my father was perhaps a little dismayed. He just shrugged it off. They did what they had to do, you know, and what was expected.
So what you're saying in a way is that being Jewish was just, it was a state of being. It's something that you were. It didn't even necessarily have to do with going to temple or observing Jewish holidays. It's just what you were.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, once it's challenged, as it is in this book, then it's something else. Then it becomes a source of threat, and In the case of my father, my father's story is the story of fighting back. That's what he does throughout the book, and so you learn his strengths and his limitations. But all of that is aroused because of what's happened in the greater world.
You said that in writing this book you wanted to figure out how your family would have responded if the world during World War II was the world that you imagined in this novel, and the family and the whole Jewish community was potentially under attack. The mother in your book, I think, is really a hero. She's helping the people in her family. She's helping people outside of her family and doing it without calling attention to herself. She's bolstering the egos of the men in her family, not, you know that kind of stereotype, you know, Jewish mother of Jewish fiction, of some Jewish fiction, where the mother is domineering and controlling and all of that.
I've heard about it.
Yes, right. Yes, precisely. So this mother is not that at all. I think she's really a quiet hero. And which was your mother closer to? You know, the mother in this novel or the mother in other novels that you read?
Well, this is the first chance the first time I've ever really used my family as it was in a book. Every time I've written a book previously in which there's a mother or a father, it's always been according to the my betters, mine. I remember your friend was greatly surprised once when he met my father, and he says, "You're supposed to be dead." He meant he would die. There was a father who died in one of the Zuckerman books. My father said, "Be patient." in inventing the big thing, the Lindbergh thing, after having done that, I did not want to invent a family. The whole thing would have gotten, in my mind, as I thought of it at the time, would have gotten terribly confused and also less believable. It seemed to me I could make the book believable for the time the reader was reading it by saying, well, look, this happened to me, and it happened to my father and my mother and my brother, and that somehow, somewhere along the way, I hope early on, they would cease to be as skeptical as they had a right to be about the premise of the book and just think that this had happened, and that my strategy then was to make them think it had happened by using my family. And so the more extreme cases in the book are invention. My family was rather ordinary, but Alvin is an invention, and Rabbi Bengelsdorf, as far as I know, is an invention, and the aunt is an invention, but particularly Alvin. I needed to bring the chaos into the house, and I wasn't going to get any chaos out of my family. That's my
well,
good
why,
luck.
Why not? What was the characteristics of your family that?
Well, it was my good luck as a child. Hardworking, tremendously responsible, tremendously dutiful, tremendously predictable. Everything that is paradise for a kid. Or maybe not, but at least it was in my case. And also a certain amount of latitude given to two boys to do more or less what they wanted within the boundaries. I've represented them as accurately as I possibly can in this book. My brother, I took a few liberties with, obviously. I mean, my brother plays the heavy in this book. He's the kid who sort of goes over to Lindbergh. And I actually didn't know whether he was going to love that when I was doing it. I have him being enchanted by the Lindbergh magic, as many kids would have been. Because he's that much older. He's supposed to be, I think, 13 or so in the book. And he's abducted like the rest of America. But that's an explanation I had to make to him before he read it.
So how did your brother react when he read it?
I sent him a manuscript. My brother is rather laid back, and we're very close, and he's exceedingly kind. And he said, you made me more interesting than I was.
Having just written this novel about the events following an election, are you carefully following the presidential campaign now, and do you have any thoughts about it that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Yes, of course I'm following it. Largely with dismay. Let me put it in the context of this book if I can, okay? Why are people so engaged by this story that takes place in 1940 and 42? And why are they so interested in joining then to now? And it seems to me that what they recognize that is analogous is the state of fear. And that there's so much fear of terrorism, and among the people I know, fear of a Bush victory, genuine fear, that they grasp this book like a talisman, you know, because it's full of fear. And the first line of the book is that fear presides over these memories. And the atmosphere of fear sort of resembles their own perception of things now. I think that's I'm not upset about that at all. It's a measure. I think there seems to be a lot of interest in this book, and I think a lot of it has to do with the moment that we're in. I think if I'd written this book 2 years back, which I could have, but for the fact that I was writing something else, it might well be that there wouldn't be this interest. But the despair, the fear, I think has a lot to do with it.
I have one last question for you, and this has to do with writing and obsession. You've said that you write to prevent your mind from obsessing about nothing. I guess when you're writing, you can obsess about what you're writing. If you weren't writing and your mind was obsessing about nothing, what would the nothing likely be? Like, what are those kind of more petty obsessions that seem kind of pointless and unproductive compared to the obsessions of writing, which...
Yeah. Well, why did the cleaning lady use Lysol on the kitchen floor? Because I can't stand the stink. And I go in to eat lunch, and it stinks of Lysol. And so I have to go out and get Mr. Clean instead, you see. Lemon-scented. Etc. That's the nothing.
Okay.
Whereas if I'm writing, I don't care what she washes the floor with.
Do you dwell on yourself with the same obsession if it's not focused on writing?
Well, it depends if I have something to dwell on. If I'm, yes, I do. I dwell on the fact that I'm not writing.
There you go. Very good. Okay. And is that painful if you're not writing to dwell on that and obsess about the failure of not writing? And
it's painful for me.
Yeah. Well, Philip Roth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Philip Roth's new novel is called The Plot Against America.